I want you to look at your watch right now. If you're driving, if you're folding laundry, just look at the time. 55 minutes. That is how long Patrick Clancy was gone on January 4th, 2023. He went to CVS for a prescription, then to a restaurant for takeout. In those 55 minutes, the world as he knew it, the world of 5-year-old Cora, 3-year-old Dawson, and 8-month-old Callan simply ceased to exist. Welcome to the In Between podcast. I'm your host, Mel Barrett. The prosecution calls it a window of opportunity. They say Lindsay Clancy, Patrick's wife, Google mapped the driving distance to ensure she had enough time to use exercise bands as ligatures. They say Lindsay Clancy was a woman who was, quote unquote, having one of her best days, texting photos of her kids playing in the snow just hours before. But here's the thing about the in-between. The best day is often the most dangerous day, because in the world of psychiatric collapse, functioning is sometimes just the final flickering of the lights before the power goes out for good. While Patrick picked up dinner, Lindsay Clancy killed her 3 children and tried to kill herself. Before the headlines, the Clancys were described as a completely normal, loving family living in a quiet suburban home on Summer Street in Duxbury, Massachusetts. Lindsay Clancy was a 32-year-old labor and delivery nurse at Massachusetts General Hospital. Her colleagues described her as an amazing mother, nurse, and friend, who was an incredible asset to the medical family. She was known for her dedication to the mothers and babies she cared for, and neighbors recalled her as a doting parent who was frequently seen playing with her 3 children. However, the defense argues that behind this perfect exterior, Lindsay was a troubled soul, battling a severe psychiatric collapse. In the months leading up to the tragedy, she was prescribed 13 different psychiatric medications to treat escalating anxiety, insomnia, and intrusive thoughts following the birth of her 3rd child. Patrick worked as a consultant for a technology company and was deeply devoted to his family. Neighbors often saw him in the backyard playing with the kids. And he described his 6-year marriage to Lindsay as wonderful. In the wake of the tragedy, Patrick has become a central figure in the public discourse surrounding this case. Despite the unimaginable loss, he has been vocal in his support for his wife, famously stating, "I wasn't married to a monster. I was married to someone who got sick." He has since moved to Manhattan to escape the media frenzy and has filed a civil lawsuit against his wife's medical providers, alleging that their negligence and overmedication directly led to the collapse of his family. I'm a researcher at heart, and when I saw the medication list in this case, my blood went cold. So let's get into the weeds on it. Between September 2022 and January 2023, Lindsay Clancy wasn't just on some meds. She was a revolving door for the pharmaceutical industry, 13 different prescriptions. In the medical world, this is called polypharmacy. When you stack these drugs, the side effects don't just add up, they multiply. One side effect, akathisia. An internal restlessness so profound people describe it as wanting to jump out of their own skin. Was the premeditation the prosecution sees actually just the hyperfixated ritualistic behavior of a brain poisoned by a chemical cocktail? We're not just talking about a couple of pills. We're talking about 13 medications in the span of 4 months. When I'm researching these cases, I'm always looking for the tipping point. For Lindsay, that point was October 2022. She'd had her 3rd baby in May. By September, what was deemed postpartum depression was clawing at her. She reached out to Dr. Jennifer Tufts and nurse practitioner Rebecca Hoyota. Instead of a steady hand, she got a chemical flood. Here is the terrifying reality of her medicine cabinet. She started on Zoloft. It didn't work. They switched her to Prozac, then Lexapro. Every time you switch an SSRI, you're looking at a 2 to 3 week adjustment window where the brain is in total chaos. To deal with the jitters caused by the SSRIs, they gave her Klonopin, then Valium, then Ativan. These are benzodiazepines. They don't fix the problem. They just numb the nervous system. Lindsay was only sleeping 2 to 3 hours a night, so they added Ambien, Trazodone, and Seroquel, a heavy-duty antipsychotic often used off-label for sleep. Her husband, Patrick, he saw it happening. He saw her becoming vacant. He saw the tremors. He told the doctors, quote, "You're turning her into a zombie," end quote. But the response from the medical team, they increased the dose. Or add a 14th pill to manage the side effects of the 13th. And this is the part of the story that really breaks my heart, because Lindsay wasn't suffering in silence. She was shouting for help in every clinical setting available. I want to take you from December 2022 through January 2023 in Lindsay's life. In early December, Lindsay makes multiple calls to her psychiatrist reporting worsening suicidal ideation. She tells them that she feels like she can't function as a mother. She's a labor and delivery nurse, remember? She knows what well looks like, and she knows that she isn't it. In late December, she seeks emergency care at a local hospital. She's terrified of her own thoughts. They evaluate her, tweak her meds, and send her home. On January 1st, while the rest of the world is making resolutions, Lindsay is checking herself into McLean Hospital, one of the best psychiatric facilities in the world. She stays for 5 days. On January 5th, she is discharged. Why? Because the staff at McLean reportedly told her she didn't have postpartum psychosis. They diagnosed her with generalized anxiety. They sent her home with, you guessed it, more prescriptions. From January 5th to January 24th, she is enrolled in an intensive outpatient day program. She drives there every day, sits in the groups, talks to the therapists, and drives home. And on the morning of January 24th, just hours before everything shattered, she was at the pediatrician with Cora. The pediatrician said she seemed normal. But normal is a performance. Underneath, she was hearing a male voice telling her it was her last chance. She was a woman who had been to the ER, to McLean, and to daily therapy, and yet the system still handed her a grocery list and sent her husband out for takeout.
If I could go back in time, I'd have called McLean and said, take her away, lock the door. Keep her in there for a year if you have to. According to The New Yorker, Lindsay was hospitalized at McLean, a psychiatric facility. The article states she was on 13 psychiatric drugs over 4 months, but fewer in the days leading up to the killings. Patrick said none of her mental health providers warned him of postpartum psychosis.
Had Googled postpartum depression, had reached out to her doctors, had gone to 2 Gold Star facilities that deal with mental illness.
Jamie Belsito, the founder of the Maternal Mental Health Alliance, who had her own battle with postpartum depression, says the Clancy tragedy shows that gaps in postpartum mental health treatment persist. She says screening for postpartum psychosis, which impacts roughly 4,000 new moms a year in the U.S., is critical.
How do we let the families know ahead of time? Grandma, grandpa, the partner, everybody. And then how can we make it that women are getting screened well before that 6-week follow-up appointment at the OBGYNs?
I want to walk you through the Tuesday, not the headlines, but the minutes, because in this case, the minutes are where the prosecution and the defense are fighting their war. So from 7:30 to 10 a.m. The day starts like any other in a house with 3 kids. Lindsay takes her daughter Cora to a doctor's appointment. Think about that. She's performing the ultimate act of mothering, taking her child to a checkup, while her own mind is allegedly disintegrating. The pediatrician later noted that Lindsay seemed perfectly normal, but this is a mask. This is the nurse who knows how to present well, even when the building is on fire. From 12 to 4 p.m., she's home. She plays outside with the kids in the snow. She takes photos. She sends them to her husband and her mother. The prosecution calls this evidence of a good day. I call it the quiet before the storm. At 4:02 p.m., this is a pivotal point. Lindsay searches Kids Miralax on her phone. Then she searches for the CVS in Kingston. Then she searches the menu for 3 Mile Feast, a local restaurant. At 4:47 p.m., she calls the restaurant. She places an order for Mediterranean Power Bowls. The host who took the call later testified she didn't sound slurred, she didn't sound off. She sounded like a mom ordering dinner. At 5:06 p.m., Lindsay texts her husband, Patrick. He's working in his home office in the basement. She asks him to go pick up the Miralax and the food. At 5:15 p.m., Patrick leaves. He's at CVS at 5:32 p.m. He even calls Lindsay from the store because he's not sure which Miralax to get. She answers. She tells him. He says she sounded fine. 5:15 p.m. to 6:10 p.m. This is the in-between. This is the 55-minute window. According to the prosecution, this is when the male voice, Lindsay later described, becomes the only thing she can hear. She takes the children down to the basement, one by one. Cora, 5. Dawson, 3. Callan, 8 months. She uses exercise bands, those long, stretchy bands you find in any home gym, as ligatures. Think about the physical act of that. This wasn't a momentary snap. This was a process. The prosecution uses this to prove premeditation. that she had to move from one child to the next. The defense uses it to prove a total psychotic break, that a woman who loved her children could only do something this horrific if she was no longer inhabiting her own body. At 6:09 p.m., Patrick arrives home. He walks into a house that is too quiet. He heads upstairs to the bedroom. The door is locked. He breaks it down. He sees the window open. He looks out and sees Lindsay on the ground. She has jumped from the second story, a 20-foot drop. At 6:11 p.m., Patrick calls 911. You can hear the transition in that call. At first, he's focused on Lindsay. She's conscious. He asks her, "Where are the kids?" She looks at him and says, "In the basement." At 6:13 p.m., Patrick finds his children in the basement, still with the bands around their necks. Shortly thereafter, paramedics arrive and begin working on Lindsay. She is asked if she knew what day it was. She did. She was asked her name. She knew it. But when asked why she did it, she allegedly said she heard a voice and that it was her last chance. It takes 55 minutes to destroy a life, but it took 4 months of 13 different medications to get to that basement.
Back now with our GMA cover story. The husband of a woman charged with murdering their three children is asking the public to forgive her. Mona Kosarabdi is here with the story. Good morning, Mona.
George, good morning. Patrick Clancy says losing his children has been unimaginably painful. The oldest, just 5 years old. But he also spoke of Lindsay's deteriorating condition and said nothing matched the intense love the real Lindsay had for her kids.
This morning, the husband of the Massachusetts woman accused of killing their three children says he forgives her and is asking others to do the same. Patrick Clancy making a heartfelt statement on GoFundMe, saying, quote, "The real Lindsay was generously loving and caring towards everyone, me, our kids, family, friends, and her patients." Our affiliate, WCVB, spoke to a family member.
Which is beautiful, beautiful children.
According to police, Patrick Clancy called 911 Tuesday after his wife, Lindsay, attempted suicide. First responders then found his kids, ages 5, 3, and 8 months old, unconscious inside the home with traumatic injuries. Two of the children died that same day, the 8-month-old a few days later. Lindsay is currently hospitalized, facing murder and assault charges.
Before a defense can be started or even discussions of trial, she has to be proven competent to stand trial and to be able to aid in her defense.
In his post, Patrick Clancy writes about the couple's relationship, saying in part, quote, "Nothing matched her intense love for our kids and dedication to being a mother. It was all she ever wanted. Her passion taught me how to be a better father."
This brings us to the lawsuit filed in January 2026. Patrick Clancy is suing the providers for abject failure. He's arguing that they relied on 17-minute video calls instead of looking at her in person. They didn't see the way her hands shook. They didn't see the radical erosion of her soul. When we go to trial on July 20th, 2026, this is what the jury has to decide. Was this a woman who planned a murder, or was this a woman whose brain was a house on fire, and every treatment the doctors provided was just more gasoline? Now let's talk about something that happened just recently in 2025 and 2026. This case isn't just about medicine, it's also about the First Amendment. In October 2024, The New Yorker published a massive profile on Patrick Clancy. It was raw, it was haunting, and the prosecution immediately subpoenaed the reporter's notes and audio tapes. Because Massachusetts doesn't have a reporter shield law, the DA argued that because Lindsay has never spoken to police, those tapes are the only way to hear what she told her husband. They even claimed the article was biased in favor of her insanity defense. But I have questions. Should a journalist be forced to become an arm of the prosecution? The New Yorker fought back, citing New York shield laws, and for a while, it looked like a constitutional showdown. It highlights how desperate the state is to prove she was sane, even if it means tearing down the wall between the press and the court. In February 2025, Judge William Sullivan initially sided with the prosecution. He ordered Condé Nast, the magazine's publisher, to hand over all of the raw audio recordings and notes from Aaron Orby's extensive interview with Patrick Clancy. The prosecution's argument was essentially, Patrick has the information about Lindsay's state of mind that she's never told us. We need to see what he said off record to make sure the final article wasn't biased in favor of her insanity defense. The New Yorker didn't just comply. They filed a motion to quash the subpoena, and their response was scathing. They argued that this was a fishing expedition. They called the request a fact check by the government on a non-party press organization, which they said was alarming and far-reaching. And there was also the Shield Law standoff. Massachusetts is one of the few states that does not have a reporter shield law. The magazine argued that New York Shield Law should apply instead because that's where they are based. They warned that if journalists were forced to turn over notes every time they wrote a sympathetic profile, sources would stop talking to the media altogether. By May 16, 2025, the situation took a strange turn. The Massachusetts prosecution dropped the initial subpoena. It wasn't because they gave up on the principle, but because of a jurisdictional technicality. They realized they couldn't easily serve Condé Nast in Massachusetts because the company didn't have a registered agent there. The judge eventually allowed them to reissue the subpoena in New York. As we stand here in March 2026, the status is a bit of a stalemate. No materials have been produced. So as of late 2025, the New Yorker confirmed they had not handed over any tapes or notes. And the focus has shifted. With the trial set for July 20th, 2026, the legal energy has moved toward the bifurcated trial motion and the medical records from McLean Hospital. The government wants the truth, but at what cost to a free press? As we head toward the July 20th, 2026 trial date, the landscape has shifted. Patrick Clancy has filed a massive wrongful death suit against Lindsay's doctors, Dr. Jennifer Tufts and nurse practitioner Rebecca Hoyota. He isn't blaming his wife. He's blaming the 17-minute virtual appointments and the abject failure to recognize a radical erosion of her mental health. Lindsay's attorney, Kevin Reddington, is pushing for a bifurcated trial, one phase to determine if she did it, which she admits, and a second to determine if she was criminally responsible. He knows that if a jury sees those exercise bands, they might stop listening to the science. On February 20th, 2026, Lindsay appeared in person for the first time, paralyzed, in a wheelchair. The state is even debating whether her mental health evaluations should be videotaped so they can analyze her body language for signs of quote-unquote faking. I've seen a lot of dark things in my time, but there is something uniquely chilling about a tragedy that happens not in spite of medical care, but because of it. If Lindsay Clancy is a monster, we're safe. We aren't like her. But if she's a product of a broken system and a chemical storm, that's much scarier, because that could be anyone. I don't know what justice looks like for Lindsay's children, but I know that she's already been punished for her actions. She'll never walk again. And my guess is that she will be living inside the prison of her own head, torturing herself over what she did for the rest of her days. And what do we as a society do in this case? What does justice look like to you? I'll give you more on this story as the trial nears. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Be good people. Don't do murder. The In-Between podcast is written, edited, and hosted by me, Mel Barrett, and is a production of Ruby Grace Productions. Special thanks to my mentors, Amber Hunt, Ellen Marsh, and Rebecca Lavoie for their super smart guidance and support. If you want ad-free exclusive content, bonuses, and lives, head on over to the In-Between podcast Patreon and sign on up. The intern level starts at just $4, and there's over 100 ad-free episodes for you to binge right now. You can watch my new show, Something's Off, with Rebecca Lavoie over on YouTube at Something's Off Pod, or listen on Patreon. Episodes drop several times per week. And please tune in on Wednesdays at 7 p.m. Eastern to watch my new panel show, News Light, on YouTube, where we talk politics and the latest news affecting all of us. Stay tuned after this show for a teaser for News Light. And if you'd be so kind to like, comment, subscribe, rate, and all the things, it's super helpful for my shows and moves my content up in the algorithm. If you appreciate my work, please don't forget to tip on Venmo at Mel Barrett Writes. That's Barrett with two R's and two T's. Thanks for watching and listening. I appreciate the support so much. Hey everyone, I'm Mel Barrett and welcome to News Light. If you're here, thank you, truly, because choosing to spend part of your evening talking about politics in 2026 is, well, it's a bold choice. This show is loosely inspired by Abby Phillips' CNN panel show, News Night, whose tagline is, Americans with different perspectives aren't talking to one another. Here, they do. Mine's a little different, maybe a little more honest. Americans with different views aren't talking to one another. Here, they try, kinda. Because look, we're living in a moment where people don't just disagree. They block, they mute, they unfriend, they assume intent, They flatten each other into caricatures. And somewhere along the way, we forgot how to actually sit in discomfort long enough to listen. So that's what this space is for. It's not gotcha journalism. It's not viral dunking. It's not performative outrage. It's just real conversation. I come from investigative journalism and long-form storytelling. I care about facts. I care about sourcing. I care about power. I care about who gets hurt when narratives get sloppy. And I care about creating rooms where people can speak honestly without being shouted into silence. The goal here is to build towards something harder and more interesting, bringing in voices with different views, not to stage cage matches, but to have ethical, good faith debate. The kind that assumes humanity first, the kind that allows complexity, the kind that doesn't require anyone to become a meme. We're not here to win. We're here to understand what the hell is actually happening in this country and why. Some nights it'll be serious. Some nights it'll be messy. Some nights we'll laugh, because if we don't laugh, we're all going to need a group therapy punch card. But every night we're going to try to be real. So welcome to Newslight. We'll see you Wednesdays at 7 p.m. Eastern on YouTube at Newslight with Mel Barrett.